This is the fifth day of this March 2016 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from the previous days, a book called The Way of Korean Zen by Kusan Sunim, 20th century Korean Zen master. We're going to skip about 50 pages from where we left off yesterday just for a change of pace here. It's a section called Advice and Encouragement. And it starts off with, in italics, it starts off with a short passage and then he elaborates. So here's the first one. When you have to walk somewhere on a dark night, it is very difficult to clearly see the path ahead of you. You do not know whether the way will consist of mountains, deep gullies, swamps, thorny forests, or rock-covered ground. Remember, this his primary monastery in Korea is in a deep, remote, mountainous area. And then he continues, one by one, you may have to encounter and traverse each of these difficult terrains. But if you don't stop and continue walking carefully throughout the night, eventually the dim light of dawn will appear in the east and gradually become brighter. As the sun rises, the path ahead will become clearer and clearer, and the difficult passages will become easier to traverse. It is similar when practicing meditation. Whatever difficulties you face at the beginning, you should learn to endure them all. Whether you are beset by wandering thoughts, overcome with drowsiness, or aggravated by pains in your legs or back, you should never allow them to distract you from the meditation. If you continuously persevere, then suddenly your firm hold on the koan will appear before you as wide and boundless, as a wide and boundless path. Being able to see the path distinctly, you should make the firm resolve to swiftly advance. Now, while keeping a firm hold on the koan, you can confidently allow the mind to be as it is. In due time, your original nature will shine forth as brilliantly as the rising sun. I'm reminded here at this beginning where he talks about trying to find one's way in the dark over rough terrain. I'm reminded of this story that Tangen Roshi in Japan told while I was there at Bukokuji, where he had been hiking up in the hills above the temple, above Bukokuji, and had gotten too close to the edge of a cliff and had fallen off. This was a many years earlier. I don't know how long, but at least 10, maybe 20 or 30 years earlier. And he fell off, and it was his good karma to, on the way down, he says he's quite sure he would have suffered very serious injury, if not death. On the way down, his fall was broken by a tree branch that he thinks may have saved his life. It did leave him with a quite serious hip injury that he had to suffer with the rest of his life. But he said that on the way down, before he hit the tree branch, this is what went through his mind. Ego unnecessary. Can still hear the way he said it, and telling this story during a tea break. Ego unnecessary. It's a good metaphor, this story that Sun Kusan is telling about the growing confidence with which one can proceed through a maturing practice, how you don't feel as vulnerable as in the beginning, and also not as the growing light he's talking about is faith. Faith is our light that enables us to move through these difficulties. This mention of pain in your legs or back caught my eye because I've realized in recent years that I can't think of a single mention of physical pain in the texts of these masters from China or Japan. I can't remember a single mention of it. That is the physical pain of sitting, other pains, serious illness, but pain in the legs, the back, these kind of things. And surely they had it. Surely these guys had pain. Maybe it's just assumed. It's not even worth mentioning because that's just naturally part of practice. But here too, as your practice progresses, the pain becomes less of an issue. It may still be there, but it's becomes more manageable, and it's instead of being such a prominent theme in your practice, it steps back and this becomes kind of a background noise. Or disappears completely. It can. And then he goes on, while contemplating the koan, you should be as earnest as someone trying to extinguish a fire burning on his head, as a thirsty man in search of water, as an infant thinking of his mother's breast, as an old man worrying about his lineage dying out, or as a cat intent on catching a mouse. Well, yesterday we read that metaphor, someone trying to extinguish a fire burning on his head as a way of expressing the kind of urgency that can really galvanize one's practice. And as I said yesterday, it's probably relatively few people who have that sense of urgency day in and day out, month after month. But many people who don't relate to that sense of urgency may very well be able to do so at this stage of Sesshin. As we see this tremendous opportunity to break through our ordinary consciousness, as we see this opportunity, the Sesshin itself, growing older and the end approaching. I remember that's when I could get my horses going. And the closer we got to the end of Sesshin, became more obvious the need to accomplish this. Of course, the same Same thing happened in college when I was approaching a deadline for a paper or an exam. You can use that, though. Use that tendency, that disposition of waiting until the end is in sight to really rouse one's utmost effort. Maybe why most breakthroughs happen late in Sesshin. Here's another one. He says, in the garden of Songguangsa, that was his principal monastery, he became abbot at there is a dead juniper tree. It was planted there about 800 years ago by the Korean national master Pojo. In front of it there is an inscription which reads, if I live, you live. If I die, you die. And then he says, this has been interpreted to mean that if Master Pojo were to return to life, then this dead juniper tree would also return to life. However, this is not what it means at all. It really means that as soon as you realize your true nature and thereby transcend birth and death, simultaneously do all things in the universe transcend birth and death. Likewise, as long as you remain in delusion, subject and object appear to be separate. But as soon as you awaken, you transcend the duality of subject and object and thereby become a liberated sage. The Buddha is said to have cried out after his awakening that I don't have the quote at hand, but something like when I came to awakening, all things everywhere simultaneously came to awakening. In the sense that we see that there is just this Buddha nature. Nothing else. Everything is an expression of this Buddha nature. Ten directions, three worlds, all Buddhas, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas, Maha Prajna Paramita. All beings everywhere. The person on our left, the person on our right, person behind us, our neighbors, people in Syria, people in the worst poverty, people in Africa, everywhere, equally, Buddhas. But until that, then the world can seem to be peopled by only the deluded, only greed, anger, and delusion everywhere. Next, there are times when wandering thoughts arise and disappear incessantly. The koan is confused with dullness and distractedness, and the force of the defilement seems stronger than ever. At such times of difficulty, you might wonder how you will ever make any progress in your practice. Throughout beginningless eons, we have been afflicted by such hindrances. Yet one way to overcome them is to cultivate the following three disabilities. Blindness, although you have eyes, not knowing how to see. Deafness, although you have ears, not knowing how to hear. And muteness, although you have a tongue, not knowing how to speak. Then he explains, to be blind, deaf, and dumb in this manner means that whatever circumstances you encounter, whether good or bad, you remain just like a tree or a stone. In this way, by keeping your thoughts plain and simple, your mind will remain unhindered. Even when confronting 1,000 or 10,000 different conditions, you should be as still as cold ashes or a withered tree. In this manner, no obstacles will bar your way. In the midst of all circumstances, try and be like cold water. In this way, you will not be subjected to emotional reactions. Again, he's probably addressing his monks, and this advice is something they could apply day in and day out in the monastery, month after month. But it's good advice for us in Sesshin too. I mean, after all, Sesshin is, we are monks and nuns for a week in Sesshin, and we can contain ourselves in the same way, keep ourselves collected and non-reactive to people and things. He continues, if under all circumstances you can remain uninvolved, the koan raised in the morning will stay with you throughout the evening until the following morning. Even though 10,000 years pass by, it will continue unbroken and unshakable. In this way, you become a person who has lost his usefulness. For such a person, back and front, before and after, disappear. He's talking here about a samadhi. Thus, having no thoughts of going back or moving forward, the koan remains clear and unmixed. At this time, even though you do not raise the koan, it will arise of its own accord. And even if you do not intentionally inquire, the questioning will be there. This is almost fanatical single-mindedness with which we can, in these conditions of Sesshin, apply ourselves. It's certainly can't be done in ordinary circumstances, that is, of busy daily lives, of worldly concerns. But here we can do it. When an ordinary person begins to practice meditation, he may feel that there is something to be cultivated and something to be realized. But should he experience a great awakening, he would then understand that there is really nothing to be cultivated and nothing to be realized. This is so because there is nothing that can affect our true nature. The accomplished sage is not endowed with more of it, and the ordinary person is not endowed with less of it. The difference only lies in the fact that the sage has awakened to his true nature, whereas the ordinary person remains ignorant of it. This is an acausal perspective. This is seeing things as from the very beginning, all beings are Buddha. From this perspective, there is nothing to accomplish, nothing to attain, nothing to realize. But until we have awakened, we can't really stand on this perspective. It's more just faith. So our job is to confirm it through our direct experience. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, it is stated, "He who wishes to comprehend the state of Buddhahood should purify his mind until it becomes like empty space." And then he asks, "What does it mean to purify the mind until it becomes like empty space?" It means to reach a point where it is no longer stained by defilements. The mind is similar to empty space. Depending on the changing conditions, space may be filled with clouds, wind may blow through it, rain and snow may fall through it, the sun or moon may shine within it, or it may be enveloped in darkness. However, none of these things actually affect the nature of space itself. During a rainstorm, it does not get wet. Neither clouds, wind, moonlight, nor darkness affect the way it is. It can never be impeded or obstructed by anything. The mind truly resembles empty space when it is emptied of all delusive thinking. At this time, all thoughts of good or bad, right or wrong, this or that, disappear from the mind. Even the notions of pure lands or samsara, Buddhas or sentient beings completely vanish. But what must be done in order for all such concepts to disappear? First, you must search for the mind through meditation. By exerting much effort, the root of questioning will become firmly established in the mind. When this questioning is very stable, then in one moment, everything will dissolve and vanish. At this time, you will realize that the universe that you previously imagined to exist, in fact, does not. Although I could tell you that the universe does not really exist, it would be very hard for you to believe this. While seeming to exist, it does not actually exist. Only when you awaken will you realize this to be the case. It is not something that you can understand through words and letters. For this is the secret of the Buddhas and the patriarchs. Quote, "Even though the universe seems real, in fact, it is not." I think of the metaphor of watching a movie and seeing the images play on the screen. I've heard that when movies were introduced first to some town, little town in Italy, that the people were rioting because they took the images as real, and they were reacting to them, throwing things, and crying, and carrying on, getting angry. This is how we can come to see reality itself as in one very real sense, very essential sense. There is just this world of appearances. Remember that theme from the Lankavatara Sutra, all of our perceptions are the projection of our own mind. Mind itself is the projector of these images. When practicing meditation, there are times when it goes well and times when it goes badly. Sometimes it is as smooth as pushing a boat over ice. But you should not then give rise to thoughts of joy. In that way, you would be captured by the Mara of joy. And Mara, roughly translated, is the demon, the devil of joy. It's a devil only in as much as we may, it may take us away from our practice. This state of mind, this emotional state, if it knocks us off center and leads us away from our practice, then it really becomes an enemy. He goes on, at other times, it is as difficult as trying to pull an ox into a well. That's a good one, isn't it? But then there is no need to give rise to thoughts of sadness or failure, for in that way you would become a prisoner of the Mara of sadness and failure. That's the other, another devil. This image of trying to pull an ox into a well makes me think of what a humorist once said. Cats are different from dogs. You can't get 8 cats to pull a sled through the snow. At other times, you may suffer from headaches, dimness of vision, or a feeling as though your teeth were falling out. Sometimes when you are walking, it might seem as though on a calm day the wind is blowing or that the earth is shaking when in fact it is not. These are quite exotic makyo. At such times, do not succumb to feelings of fear or anxiety. Do not lose your hold on the koan. Such things are only temporary states of mind produced by tensions in the body. You will never achieve anything if, at these times, you cease to meditate on the koan. If anyone were to attempt to catalog the many different kinds of makyo, I think it would be an endless list. I still hear, after all these years, I hear new kinds of makyo that I'd never heard of before, besides the usual hallucinations and visual hallucinations. The nature of the entire universe is your own mind. All things are created by the mind and arise from it. So where is the creator of the universe? Your own mind alone is the creator. I could say that the creator, so-called creator of the universe, is a creation of the mind. But he continues, there is no one else who created it for you. Therefore, this universe is your own universe. This is true whether you are awakened or not. The universe can be affirmed or negated only because we are here now. If we were not present, there would be no one to make such affirmations or denials. Since we create the universe, how can one then say that we came from anywhere or will depart to somewhere else? In reality, there can never be any such coming or going. Hence, it is meaningless to talk of going to a pure land. Pure land is another sect of Buddhism, where the idea is that you want to after death, be reborn in a pure land. For how can a pure land exist elsewhere when in fact it is latent within one's own mind? I have to admit, there's no way you could disprove that at every moment we are creating our universe. That when we fall into dreamless sleep, the universe disappears. When we wake up in the morning, the universe is recreated, reborn. For things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. There are no doors or gates which open to the great way. You can neither enter it nor leave it. Throughout the Dharma worlds, as numerous as the sands along the river Ganges, there is not a single thing which is not permeated by it. It is also called the secret store of the Tathagata. He continues, there is no movement within the highest truth. It neither decreases nor increases. Throughout the worlds of the 10 directions, every single phenomenon is completely permeated by all phenomena. Hence, this truth is also called the ocean of wisdom. The radiance of the subtle principle with which all beings are endowed is extremely brilliant. Whether raising your hands, moving your feet, putting on clothes, or eating food, in every action it is clear and distinct. There's a verse in the Mumon Khan. Lifting up his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the four heavens. His body is so big, there's nowhere to put it. The subtle functioning knows no limits. Thus, the mountains being high, the oceans being vast, the flowers blooming, the birds singing, and each thing's being, long or short, there is nothing that is not the true nature. Upon awakening to your true self, you are called a Buddha. Upon forgetting your true self, you are called a sentient being. Human life is very short. It cannot last for long. Who is to blame if you live to no purpose and die in distress? Monasteries and meditation centers are the refineries of human beings. They are like furnaces that refine the ordinary person and transform her into an accomplished sage. Because gold is so highly valued in the world, people spare no expense in their search for it. First they mine the ore, then they smelt it in a furnace. Only through this process are they able to finally extract the pure gold from the other constituents. Likewise, the Buddha nature is innate within each of us. But if we do not undergo the process of cultivating the path, it will be impossible to ever discover our true nature and thus transform ourselves from an ordinary person into an accomplished sage. Last autumn, the maple trees were a brilliant red, the chrysanthemums fragrant, the mountains and rivers a magnificent sight. When we see all these beautiful things, we all know how to be happy. During endless eons, in every life, we have been praising such things. It is not only this one time that we have praised them. When the moon is bright and the wind blows, some say that the moon is shining brightly and a refreshing wind is blowing. However, others say that the moon looks bleak and the wind is dreary. In reality, do you think that the moon is shining brightly to some and bleakly to others? This is not the case. These are circumstantial impressions arising from their own minds. Things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. During endless eons in every life, we have been praising such things. It is not only this one time that we have praised them. What if he's right? What if rebirth, what if successive lives is a fact? For some people, this will inspire them to use this time, every bit of this time, to advance as far as possible, to evolve as far as possible. I suppose there could be other people who might say, well, what's the rush? I have other lifetimes. I can do this work. But I'm guessing not many people here would think that way. What is this living and dying, reliving and redying? What is Mu? Who am I? Who assumes different forms in different lifetimes? What is this? We'll stop now and recite the four vows.